out so early. Really appreciate it, Scotty. Really appreciate your being here for the Playbook Breakfast. We're going to spend the next hour talking with a member of the President's Cabinet, Jack Lew, who's the President's Budget Director, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. Has a lot under that hat. We're going to be talking about some of the reform. Jack Lew is somebody who knows both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue. His first job in Washington, 1973, he was an intern for Congresswoman Bella Abzug. There was a little turnover, and very soon he was the number two person in her office writing speeches. So I guess he knows something about getting the path to the top. He also has something in common with Don Rumsfeld. He held the job he has now before he was the OMB director at the end of the President Clinton's term. He's also lived in New York, has worked at NYU and Citi. So lots to talk about. Excited to have Jack Lew. Welcome, Mr. Lew. Thank you for coming in. Appreciate it. So we'll start with an easy one. Are we headed toward a Christmas week government shutdown crisis?
I certainly hope not. There's absolutely no reason that we should. I think that what we've seen over the last 6 months is that Congress has some choices to make. If it chooses to find a reasonable middle course, we can reach agreement where Congress can pass a bill, the President can sign it. If we go to extreme...
Wait, that's a lot of ifs.
Well, the American people very much want to see Washington being able to do its work, Congress being able to do its work. I think it's encouraging that Congress is now passing appropriation bills. They seem to be trying to break them into pieces that they can manage. You know, there's a risk. There's a risk that there is a relatively small group of members who have an inordinate amount of influence that pulls the Republican Party to an extreme position.
And who are we talking about here?
Well, we can call them the Tea Party. We can call them, 50 to 75 members of the House. You know, there's no doubt that this could become another one of those ideological head-to-head conflicts. It shouldn't and it needn't. You know, I recently wrote a letter to Congress going some detail through the kinds of issues that if they avoid them, this doesn't have to happen. I hope they take that letter the way it was meant. It was meant as a roadmap to getting the work done and doing it in a way that the American people expect Washington to work.
And are we headed toward a series of CRs or a big omnibus?
You know, I know that it's important to a lot of members, but the substance is actually more important than the form.
People here care about form.
People do care about form. You know, look, it's better for Congress to pass each appropriation bill on its own and to have a debate where you can understand what's happening inside the bill. So I'm a big believer that doing your business in the regular order is a good thing. I'm also a big believer that if you can't do your business in the regular order, doing it in an omnibus is better than not getting the job done. I think what is happening right now is Congress is trying to break these bills into groups, pass them so that they don't run into the forum opposition. The opposition, it's too big, we don't know what's in it. I hope that they can do that. In the end, if they haven't done that, they'll have no choice, as other Congresses have, but to combine them. They should be able to break it into pieces. You know, I think it really comes down to the question of, is this going to be seen as an opportunity to show that we can govern? Or is it going to be seen as an opportunity to kind of pitch partisan battles? And, you know, there's no doubt that if this becomes a debate on the repeal of financial reform or the repeal of the Affordable Care Act or taking away, the rights that women have to choice on health or any of a number of those issues that don't belong on an appropriation bill, they do belong in a political debate and reasonable opponents can disagree, it doesn't belong on an appropriation bill. If they choose to do that, it's going to get very difficult. If they choose to have the kind of negotiation between the House and the Senate to find a middle ground on funding levels within caps that we've agreed to, there's no reason for this to get jammed up. It's actually easier this year in some ways than others because we start out with an agreement on what the total spending amount is. You don't have that agreement every year. So, this would be a very good opportunity for Congress to show that it can govern.
Now you talk about Washington showing that it can govern. These cliffhanger gong shows that we've had really break through out in America, that they really show Washington frozen. It makes people hate Washington even more than they did. What's a way to get out of that cycle?
You know, I cannot tell you how strongly I believe it's important for Washington to show the American people it can do better.
We agree on that, but how do we break out of it? Or is this something we're just going to live through for a few years?
The The debate in April and the debate in August were avoidable. If you look at the end result, one could have gotten to those end results on a substantive basis without the drama. After April, we sat in the cabinet room and had a discussion with the joint leadership, and were very, very candid where, you know, the administration, the Secretary of the Treasury, myself, the President, said it will be bad for this country if we have a countdown clock to default. We need to avoid that. I don't think Congress had an ability to avoid it. They couldn't get into a place to compromise until it was the last minute.
So what will it take? Will it take a new president, a new administration, a new majority?
I actually think that we're in a slightly different environment now because the American people have told Congress it's unacceptable. Congress is very aware of how the American people view Washington, how they view Congress. It's not a good place to be. Forget about your own political fortunes. Just as a democracy, it's not a good place to be, to have public confidence and approval of the institutions of government plummeting the way they are, and to have Congress at a single-digit approval rating. I think that's gotten the attention of people who care about the institution, who care about how our system of government works. That doesn't mean that there aren't 50 or 100 members who still are going to force it to brinksmanship. Leadership is about managing that. You know, I worked for a speaker for many years. We had members who thought that the right way to deal with things was sometimes to kind of throw a monkey wrench in the works. I remember learning from Mr. O'Neill when he was speaker that, you know, you have to lay your positions out, you have to stand your ground, but you also have to govern.
And when he talked about that, what did he mean by governing? That means a different way to say that is to compromise?
So he never felt that it was an embarrassment or something to apologize for to reach an honorable compromise.
Okay.
He thought that in a system of government where you had very different views, there were some things where you drew bright lines, and there were other things where you did business to try and come up with something where you didn't humiliate either side and you did the American people's business. And you could proudly walk out together saying we did the right thing. He did it time and again.
Okay, so why has that gone out of fashion?
You know, Congress is more polarized. The populace, the American people are more polarized. You know, we get our information from the people we already know we agree with as opposed to through broadly disseminated media. So the world is a little bit different. I think that if you look at where we ended up this year in very difficult negotiations, we ended up in a place where there was reasonable compromise.
You know, if you look at the negotiations in April over appropriations bills, we ended up with Republicans reducing spending more than we wanted and us getting to a level where we could say we protected the ability to fund core priorities. That's a reasonable compromise.
Sam.
Yeah, we're just going to, if you'd be kind to just hold this for a second. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Beth.
Microphone go off?
You're back. You mentioned the letter that you sent to appropriators in October, and you mentioned it as being very detailed. This will shock you, but my colleague, the great David Rogers, would have liked a little more detail and, in fact, says that what people on the Hill want is a very defined list of what's veto bait on legislative writers. During the April CR negotiations, there's a very specific list. You're taking a little different approach this time.
The great David Rogers is a good friend of mine. We've known each other for over three decades since we both worked in the city of Boston. So I have great respect for him and his observations. I actually think the letter that I sent to Congress provided the kind of roadmap that Congress needs.
But will they get a checklist at some point?
It did two things. It had a letter which made very clear that the president was prepared, not looking forward to, but prepared to veto a bill if it crossed some important bright lines. I mean, I went through the issues when a few moments ago. If Congress is going to try and repeal financial reform and put us back into the world of the Wild West on Wall Street, the president's not going to sign a bill that does that. And the Affordable Care Act, we have to implement it, not debate right now whether or not to fund it or to limit it in riders. There are certain issues. If Race to the Top, a very important education initiative, is eliminated, he would not sign a bill. He went through a number of very central issues in the body of my letter, which I very rarely do this. I put in the letter, the president will veto the bill if it does these things. We don't take those words lightly. You often see words like, I will recommend, or senior advisors will recommend. The letter said, the president will veto. We separately went through with the appropriators all of the administration priorities, and they know kind of below the level of those issues that were in the letter what kinds of funding issues we care deeply about. they're actually working with that list. And that's what Congress always does. They never give an administration 100% of what it wants. They need to know what's important. But they need to also know that the president won't veto if a relatively small issue is 5% less than the president's request. So I think we actually gave the kind of guidance that the Congress needs. I mean, Congress has a choice to make. Congress can do business in a way that looks for how do we put together bills within a top line that we agreed to, not try to renegotiate the deals from April or August, keep the commitments that were made, and do it in a way that doesn't bring these harsh ideological issues, which frankly are more appropriate to a political campaign than working out annual funding bills, into the debate.
Okay, last question about this. You made it clear that your preference was for the specific specific bills as opposed to a big one. What is the minibus strategy? Manu Raju gave me that term.
So, look, I actually was careful to say that it's important to focus on substance rather than form. Mm-hmm. I've been part of negotiations that did all the appropriations.
But what is the minibus? Just tell us.
Congress has come up with this notion that instead of having what's called an omnibus that has all the bills together and is thousands of pages long, you take 3-4 bills at a time, put them together. It's more digestible. You can have it go to members a day before, and they can have an idea of what's in it. And I think that's a good idea. I think it's good to do the bills individually. It's good to do them in more bite-sized pieces because it's not great to have a stack of paper that's, you know, so enormous that no human being could really know what's in it if they saw it just the day before they vote on it. I think it's really important not to take hard-line positions and say it has to be done bill by bill.
I see.
It has to be done in a minibus, or it can't be done in an omnibus.
I see.
If it gets to the deadline and Congress, whatever is remaining, people misunderstand what an omnibus is or what a full-year continuing resolution is. Typically what they are at the end is a lot of separate bills that are stitched together. And the real problem isn't that it's kind of automatic legislation. The real problem is it's just too voluminous for the body to really comprehend. And I think members are legitimately concerned when you're not in the room in appropriations, how do I know what I'm voting on?
Okay. All right. As we leave this, you've expressed optimism. Is there a risk or is there a danger of a shutdown crisis that last week in December?
I think after living through April and July, any reasonable person would have to say there's risk. I don't know which choice Congress will make.
How big a risk? How worried are you?
You know, I did not believe that we were on the edge of a shutdown in September when there was a bit of a dust-up over emergency funding. I thought Congress pretty clearly indicated it wanted to avoid that, and we were able to work together to avoid that. I genuinely don't believe that Congress wants to be in that kind of a showdown. So I'm optimistic that they'll work through these issues. They'll make the right choice. They won't go through the kind of drama before. It's a kind of a funny irony to this. You get to the place that you need to get to eventually, but do you do it in a way that has self-inflicted wounds along the way or not? It wasn't good for the American economy or the world economy to go through the theatrics of July and
August. It wasn't good for Congress.
Now, the president didn't want to go through it. The president was in the negotiations willing to go substantially towards the other side's positions to try and do something big to actually address the problem. He wasn't willing to capitulate. He wasn't willing to say, you know, because I'm being threatened, anything goes. We shouldn't do business that way. Washington has always been about having leverage and being able to promote your views. But it shouldn't be about I'm willing to drive off the cliff, just dare me. And that's what July was.
Now, government used to be a very important source of R&D funds, NASA, DARPA. In this environment, it's going like that. Does that worry you?
I think that there are a lot of things to worry about with the discretion, the tight limits on domestic spending and security spending. I think if you look at the spending on R&D, it is divided between the two halves of the budget. And it's very important for this country that we maintain our cutting edge. America has been a place that has been the home to the breakthroughs in knowledge that have made possible the kind of progress and the kind of competitiveness that we've really considered to be the American hallmark. We can't stop. We can't concede that breakthroughs in knowledge will be made elsewhere, that innovation will be made elsewhere.
So we're not stopping, but we're putting on the brakes.
We'll have to make tough choices. And, you know, I'm going through the process now of reviewing agency by agency what the choices are. We're going to have to make the tough choices. And the president's guidance has been clear. He said we're going to have to tighten our belts in the things that, you know, we can either do later or do without in times of limitation.
Okay, tough.
But we have to double down on the things that the future is really hinged on, and research is one of those.
Okay. Tough choices, tightening our belts. What is that code for? Translate that.
It's code for we'll have less money to spend next year than we had last year, and it means that there are going to be reductions in a lot of parts of the budget, and it means we have to do it in a way that we make sure we maintain our competitive edge, we don't do things that are unfair to those who are most in need, and it means that there will be a lot of disappointed programs and communities because we don't have the kinds of funding levels we've had in the past. And I can't sit here today and walk through what I haven't even yet presented to the president as choices, but the arithmetic is kind of unavoidable. If you have less dollars and, you know, programs require increases to serve the same number of people, you either have to move money around or serve fewer people.
So that makes you the bearer of bad news internally.
Well, it goes with the turf at the Office of Management and Budget that you have to create an environment where trade-offs can be visible and seen. I don't actually consider it all bad news. This may be my own idiosyncratic view of the world, but I think that you make better decisions when you're allocating scarce resources with the knowledge that it's very important to put your money in the right place. You don't always
make... That's going to be a tough sell to come as some of your constituents.
It is a tough sell,
maybe,
but...
to your boss.
It is a tough sell, but, you know, I have to tell you, you look at the security side of the budget. We are in the middle of a strategic review with the Pentagon where we're asking the kinds of questions that should be asked even if we didn't have caps on spending. What are we trying to accomplish? What are our goals? What is the indispensable? What is the nice to have, not need to have? What capabilities do we need to have? We have to do that on the domestic side as well. And that does mean that there will be things that we do less of. And it is a tough message. I'm not going to deny. You know, I've done this job before. I did it at a time when we had more money to spend than we were willing to spend because our goal was to reduce the deficit. In an odd way, it's easier now than it was then. Because in the 1990s, when all of my colleagues in the cabinet knew that there was money that I wasn't willing to spend, they knew I had a choice. I think there's a broad understanding. It was a pretty public debate over the caps on spending in July. There isn't a person in Washington or hardly in the newspaper reading world who doesn't know that we have a limit. And that changes the shape of the debate. I'm seeing the kinds of submissions from agencies that show that they understand it. It doesn't mean they're not hard choices. It doesn't mean that we won't have some moments when I am the bearer of bad news. You know, I think that how you do that matters as much as what you do. And if you do it with respect for agencies. One thing that's important to me, we're in a place now where the fact that something will get a lower funding level doesn't mean it's a bad thing to do. And we have to kind of simultaneously try to root out waste wherever we have it, but not equate any reduction with waste.
Okay. Good luck selling that. In just a couple minutes, I'm going to bring in Ed O'Keefe for the Washington Post with a question. We'll get a microphone to him. But first, we're going to talk about the super committee. Yeah. When you were on the Sunday shows this summer, you made it clear that the administration preferred a grand bargain back then to a super committee. How's it going?
Well, I think the world is waiting anxiously to see if the 12 members of the House and Senate on the Super Committee are able to reach the kind of agreement that they need.
What does your intel tell you? You know all of them.
You know, I'll tell you, I've talked to a lot of members of the Super Committee. I try to stay in touch with them, you know, because it's obviously very important. I think that we have a habit in Washington of trying to write obituaries while the patient is still fighting. And the super committee is not done. There's no major undertaking like this where a few weeks out we've been able to accurately predict whether it would work, whether it wouldn't work, if it worked, where it would go. I do live my life as an optimist, but I look at this challenge that the committee was given. There's no doubt but that substantively it's important. The president made that clear in his negotiations in July and August. He made it clear when he sent his recommendations to the supercommittee, where he showed them a balanced approach that more than accomplishes the task they were given and actually would get us to a $4 trillion savings. I think this group of senators and congressmen, for the most part, know how important it is. They don't want to fail. We've given them our advice. You know, that's why the president submitted his comprehensive proposal. We've been available for the kind of technical support that people come to us for. And I think we have to give them some space to do their work, which is what they're doing right now.
So you've been giving advice, giving technical support. Like, you personally are known as a very skilled negotiator, going back to the O'Neill days, certainly under Clinton. You were very active. Is it hard for you to be on the sidelines of this tectonic negotiation?
I don't feel on the sidelines.
But you are. The supercommittee is its own organism.
It is its own organism. But we went from a negotiation between the president and the speaker to putting together the president's unilateral proposal with no break between the two. We submitted that. The president submitted it to Congress in September. And we feel that we have laid before the committee a blueprint that would enable it to get its work done if it looks for a balanced approach. The Republicans have to make a decision that they're going to put everything on the table. We've made it clear we'll put everything on the table. Democrats in Congress have made it clear they'll put everything on the table. This can't be done by just saying we're going to cut discretionary spending or we're going to cut entitlements. Everything, including revenues, has to be on the table. Yesterday was a hopeful day. I mean, in a year in which there has been very little deviation from party line, you saw dozens of members of Congress say everything should be on the table. And I read in the paper this morning that the kind of keeper of the flame on the tax pledge, Grover Norquist, said, "Oh, they said it's on the table, but it didn't say it should be in the agreement." It has to start by being on the table. You know, in the 1980s, the 1990s. One of the most important jobs that I played when I worked for the Speaker was to make sure that things didn't get taken off the table, because if you lock all the doors and the house is on fire, you're in trouble.
Okay. So does yesterday's development suggest to you that Speaker Boehner might be more of a willing partner than you felt he was a few months ago?
You know, I think that when the President and the Speaker were meeting through the summer, it was he was a willing partner. There was the kind of conversation that presidents and speakers should have. I think what happened at the end of it was he had a caucus that was not willing to go where he was prepared to go, and things seized up. Yesterday was a little bit of a hopeful sign because it showed that, you know, like any caucus, it has different views. You know, when I worked for Speaker O'Neill, we knew that you couldn't get to a bipartisan agreement with 100% of Democrats with you. It's almost by definition, if it's going to appeal to everyone in one party, that it's going to be hard to put together the kind of, you know, great middle ground where most of both party can be there. I hope we get back to that, because that's the best thing for the American people.
You talked about the grand bargain seizing up, and there were a number of causes. It's like a plane crash. There's usually lots of different causes. How much of a factor did the gang putting out a bigger number just then affect
Look, there's no doubt that that there were a lot of things going on. It wasn't just the two great leaders in a room. It was in an environment where you know, all of Washington in one way or another was engaged. I think that the Gang of Six, when it grew to a much larger bipartisan group, was trying very hard to show that there is a bipartisan consensus for balance and for doing something big.
But they wound up undermining what they were after.
I think that we won't know until the end of the story what was advancing the cause and what was undermining it. You know, I think if you go back to the Bull-Simpson Commission, having a bipartisan recommendation for a balanced approach was critically important. And I think having a group of senators, Republicans and Democrats, step forward and say taxes have to be on the table was important. Now, clearly, when there are Republicans who are willing to do more taxes, it does make it hard to go to your own party and say we should have no taxes.
Okay.
But I don't think we would have ended up in a place where no taxes was acceptable without that. At every point in the negotiations over the summer, said it has to be balanced.
He said we won't know till the end of the story. In this context, what do you mean by the end of the story?
Well, we have chapters, at least. We'll know in a few weeks if the supercommittee is able to meet its deadline. We'll know a few weeks after that if Congress can use the expedited procedures to pass it. And I certainly hope they can. I think it would be an enormous shot in the arm to confidence in our system of government and to our economy for Washington to show that we can overcome what was seen as dysfunction.
All right. Ed O'Keefe is the Federal Eye columnist for the Washington Post. He has a question.
Director, thanks for doing this.
Okay. We can hear you.
Okay. Two quick ones. The president scored a big laugh back in the State of the Union joking about salmon. And your office put together a 90-page proposal on reorganizing government. We're hearing some of the Republican contenders may be about to unveil some reorganization ideas, just wondering if the White House is ever going to share theirs. And second, you say belt tightening is coming. You can't share many details. But if you're, say, a federal employee across the country, should you be preparing for another year of a pay freeze right now or having to pay more for your benefits, or is that something that they're not going to have to worry about after this two-year freeze ends?
Going to your first question, I think this question of reorganization, consolidation is very important. We actually made some real progress this year, and this is an area that I've worked for decades on. We had dozens and dozens of education programs that had overlapping purposes and multiple administrative structures. We consolidated them to do better at education. What the president said in the State of the Union about regulating salmon in three different places, depending on whether they were swimming or whether they were smoked, was, it wasn't just a joke. I mean, the American people look at Washington and they say, businesses look at what they do and they say, how can we do it most efficiently? How can we do it most effectively? It's really hard in Washington because you have agencies that have hard boundary lines, jurisdictional lines. You have congressional committees that have hard jurisdictional boundaries. You have interest groups that are organized around the status quo. We're working very hard on some ideas on how to do government better. What label goes on it, whether it's reorganization, consolidation, efficiency, is less important than doing our jobs, which is as stewards of the public fisc, demonstrating to the American people that we're running the government in the 21st century best way we can. So there'll be more to come on that.
And just to stick to this before you get to the second part of his question, so the first part was going to be trade, competitiveness, export. Like, is that the recommendation that's gone to the president?
I'm not going to get ahead of announcements that the president made.
No, I'm asking what you've done. Have you made progress with your part of it, which was to get a recommendation?
We've made progress on the work that the president outlined in the State of the Union. We don't yet have recommendations that are public and or ready to be announced. But we're working on a lot of other areas also.
And so, what's an example of the other areas?
I used education as an example to try to give you something that's rooted in something that happened. Mm-hmm. I have a longstanding practice of keeping internal conversations internal until they're ready to be public, so I'm not going to go through the details.
And we were supposed to, there were originally supposed to be recommendations in June. Like, how soon, do you think we'll see something public on this?
There's work that's underway, so.
Okay. All right. The second part was
second
about the pay freeze.
It's premature to answer the question. We haven't made decisions yet. We haven't made recommendations to the president yet on any of the major decisions in the budget. So we're in the season where we're getting close but not at decision points. So I'm actually in the relatively easy position of saying, I don't know. I will say this. The American people are hurting.
So it's possible.
I'm just saying we haven't made a decision yet. So we're looking at options across the government on policies right now. So nothing is decided on a specific basis. It's been a tough time for the American people, and it's not just federal workers who have had to manage without pay raises. There are a lot of people around the country who've lost their jobs, who've seen declines in their wages, for whom not having had a pay raise would be good news compared to the reality they're living with. So I think it's really important that federal workers not think that they're kind of being singled out. I personally, and I know the president, has the highest regard and value the work that federal workers do. It is the workforce that works for the U.S. government. So we don't get to make decisions in directly in other parts of the workforce. I think that it's sometimes misunderstood as a kind of vote of confidence in federal workers as opposed to a budgetary necessity. And wherever we go, on whether we can afford a pay raise or not, I think it's important for federal workers not to be treated as if they're the problem. They're working hard. They're doing extraordinary, important work. And I don't think they get enough respect. And I don't think that it's just a question of do you have a pay raise or don't you have a pay raise. I mean, I think that federal workers don't want to be treated as if they're the problem. And we have to separate those issues.
Okay. I'm going to bring you into the conversation in just a second, so signal for a microphone if you have a question. But I'm going to ask you about regulation. We hear a lot about that. A lot of people think that they kill jobs. There's been polls that show it's a clear vulnerability for this administration. Your office has tried to take the offensive on that a little bit.
I think that the administration, before I was at OMB and since, has an extraordinarily good record on regulation. It has, in terms of the benefits outweighing the costs of what we've done on the regulatory side, we have the best record in modern times, better than the Clinton administration, better than the Bush administration.
But you've called for a reexamination of all of them.
And quite importantly, and not just looking at new regulations, we've said, let's go back and look at the regulations on the books. And if things don't make sense, let's change them. You know, one of the rules that we changed was tankers were treated the same, whether they were carrying milk or petroleum. Now, it didn't make sense. I mean, spilling milk when you're driving a truck is very different than spilling oil. So it defies common sense to think that we shouldn't ever look back. Because you enact a rule, you promulgate a rule for one reason, and then it's implemented, and it may have the consequence you intended. It may not. So we've quite aggressively gone back, and not just with the regulatory agencies that report directly to the president, but even with the independent regulatory agencies, said, let's look back and examine the body of rules. And dozens of rules with billions of dollars of savings have been revised. I think that there's obviously there's a lot of politics in the debate over regulatory approaches. But I think there's something that is profoundly contradictory. There is an argument that Republicans make that the uncertainty of the regulatory process is part of the reason that the economy is held back. They call it a jobs bill to create certainty.
That's not an argument that some Republicans make. That's a very widely held view
in
business.
And if you look at what they're arguing, let's not implement financial reform. Let's hold up the rules on the Affordable Care Act. They are magnifying the uncertainty by trying to delay clarity. We agree that clarity in rulemaking process is critical and certainty for business is critical, but the way to get that is not to put dilatory delaying things in the way of clarity. That's the part that's contradictory.
And you're going to remain aggressive about the look back?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think we think it's been a very effective, on the order of 30 agencies who have come back with ideas. It's something that should be something that's never done because we should always, look back and assess the body of work we've done. You know, if we could ever pass appropriation bills, we should do it on the spending side, too, and look back and see how are we doing implementing what we do on the spending side. We're always just in time finishing the year's business halfway through the year. We don't do enough of the kind of retrospective and evaluative part of government. On the regulatory side, we have a little bit more control, and I think that we, in general, what the president has been emphasizing in recent weeks is, we don't have control over everything Congress does. The things that we do in the executive branch, we ought to be driving forward and doing it in a disciplined way, in a professional way, addressing things that matter to the American people. The look back is consistent with that, but so is looking at what executive powers the president has to do things like helping, fix some of the problems students have in consolidating their loans and having more affordable loan repayments and, homeowners have in terms of getting their mortgages refinanced. So they're kind of connected. It's an executive action that we're going to push really hard on.
Is there a question in this zip code? Yes, sir, and if you wish, say who you are.
My name is Ryan Randall. Thanks for joining us this morning. My question, as you're looking to cut trillions of dollars of spending across programs, one needs to target the largest programs or items within the budget. And currently under the budget, Social Security is larger than defense. Why do you hear so much about the reductions in defense, but so little about doing anything to tinker with Social Security?
Well, I don't think it's true that you don't hear much about Social Security. You may not have seen much action, but there's been a pretty full-throated debate over Social Security for the 30 years that I've been in Washington. I think Social Security is different than other programs. People pay into Social Security. Social Security financing is ongoing with a payroll tax that's dedicated to it. And in some ways, it's the easiest of the entitlements to address because it's just arithmetic and you can see with clarity what changes would do. In healthcare, it's much more challenging because you don't know with certainty what the impact of your policy changes are. The problem with Social Security, having lived through and been part of the 1983 Social Security agreement, it's, I think, very important to deal with Social Security from the perspective of how do we make sure Social Security is sound and there for people paying for it. The 1983 Social Security Agreement had profoundly significant budgetary impacts, but it wasn't done as a budget bill. It was done as making sure Social Security is sound. Right now, we don't face the same threat that we faced in 1983, thankfully. In 1983, we were weeks away and then days away from the trust fund not having enough money to pay benefits. We now have a longer time horizon. I think it's a challenge for Washington to deal with problems that are not going to ripen in the next 2 years, 4 years, 6 years. The president has been very clear in his State of the Union, in his budget, in his many speeches. He wants to deal with Social Security. He wants Social Security to be there for us, for our children and our children's children. And we should get on with that work, and we should do it in a bipartisan way. I don't think we're going to be able to deal with Social Security if it's in a highly charged ideological environment. You're never going to see Social Security reform on a bipartisan basis if it's all done by cutting benefits. You're just not. You didn't see it in 1983. You won't see it in the future. So we're going to have to get to a place where it's balanced, shared sacrifice, and fundamentally about making sure Social Security is sound.
So this sounds like 2013?
I can't say what year it is. I mean,
it's not
the sooner the better.
Right.
Social Security is not driving our deficit right now in the same way that other things are. Clearly, it affects our deficit. But I don't think if we were to, in a world where Social Security was reduced so that the Social Security payroll tax wasn't needed to pay for it, you'd also lose the revenues because that tax is tied to Social Security.
But Social Security has a cash negative basis this year, and it's going to run through perpetuity. In 20 years in the future, obviously, they're going to have to cut benefits.
Let's just be clear that Social Security is drawing on a trust fund that was built up. For decades, Social Security payroll taxes were set aside. They were used to fund defense spending. They were used to fund tax cuts. They were used for a host of reasons. When Social Security then goes to redeem the deposits made into the Social Security trust fund, I think it's a little bit inaccurate to say it's cash flow negative and it's causing the problem. If you put money in the bank and you go to the bank to withdraw it, and the bank doesn't have money, is it your fault, or is it the bank's?
All right. I think we have a question back here. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. The Census Bureau The Census Bureau just announced that during the third quarter, the rate of homeownership actually grew for the whole country, driven primarily by minority households. It showed, for example, that while growth among non-Hispanic white households grew by only 18,000 units, among Hispanic households it grew by nearly 300,000 units, 280,000 units. My question is, does this mean that if hardworking, creditworthy, responsible minority households can achieve homeownership when they are given affordable, safe, and sound loans, will the administration use this kind of information as it formulates housing policy and it begins to reform mortgage finance?
Thank you, sir. And tell us who you are.
Alejandro Becerra, National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals.
Yeah, I think that it is critically important to our economy and the social fabric of our country that creditworthy borrowers, regardless of their ethnicity, have access to mortgages. The problem that we got into was when the standards for making mortgages went kind of haywire, and mortgages were being made that people couldn't afford to keep up with, where a bubble was being inflated, and when it burst. We can't go to a place where creditworthy borrowers don't have access to mortgages. And I think that's part of the kind of working out of this kind of burst bubble that we're going through right now.
And I apologize. I think I missed somebody who had the microphone before. Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah.
Thank you.
And please tell us who you are.
It's Thanks. Susan Garrity. You spoke of the halcyon days of Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, and you can even go back to Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich. But you look at the relationship between the White House today and Congress, and you've said, you know, it's not a particularly fantastic relationship. And yet you look at the way the White House and Congress interacted back, what you pointed out, it was very different. Majority Leader Cantor has asked several times about meeting with the president. Republicans have said they're open to meeting with the president, yet there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of conversation since the summer. Do you anticipate in the future that we'll see a little bit less insular White House and a little bit more welcoming of the opposition?
I'm not sure I agree with the characterization of the White House. First of all, as we look to the past, we have to be careful not to over-romanticize the halcyon days. We had pretty tough fights between the Reagan White House
but
and
remarkable
the
results.
Congress.
Yeah.
And the Clinton White House and the Gingrich Congress. Mr. O'Neill used to say, during the day you fight it out, and at night you could, lift a glass and have a social evening. And I don't think we have that same kind of social life on the Hill, between the Hill and the Congress, as we used to. People run home to their districts. They're not here. You don't have the kind of bonds that help you get through the tough fights. I don't think there's been a modern president who's spent more time in meetings with leaders of Congress than President Obama. I know when I worked for Speaker O'Neill, he wasn't in the White House as much as the Speaker and the Majority Leader were this summer. And even in the budget negotiations in the Clinton administration, there were brief periods when there were meetings, but not the kind of intensive engagement that we had this past year, both in April and July. I think the president showed an extraordinary willingness to do whatever it took to help drive the process towards closure. So I don't think the problem here is the president's willingness to engage. The president has made clear, he was open to compromise. He's made clear when he's putting a program of his own forward. He's reached out on a personal basis. He's developed relationships. Fundamentally, there has to be a desire to get to an agreement. And all the meetings and all the dinners and all of the socializing, if there's not that desire to get to an agreement, don't work. And I think we learned this summer that the president was committed to getting to an agreement. And for one reason or another, they were unable to in the Congress.
Now, next year with their campaign, there may not be a lot of action on the Hill. There may not be a lot of new policy out of the White House. Your office is one of the few that's going to be going full steam next year. And you talked about how you'd begun the agency reviews for 2013. What have you learned from that process so far?
It's always an eye-opening month or two to go through the agency reviews because it's a chance to step back and kind of lift the hood and see what's working, what's not working, where are the things we need to do.
And how many of these are you personally involved in?
Oh, my gosh, there's probably 25 of them.
They go like 2 hours? It's like this very
well,
in-depth, right?
Quality of life isn't so high during this period. You go home with about 3 hours of reading every night, and you have about 2-3 hours of meetings every day, and then you have the rest of your job to do.
Okay, if I'm the playbook agency and I come in to you, how long do I have to make my case?
The reviews generally go for about 2 hours. There's usually a major agency. Sometimes there's some small agencies as part of it. That's me meeting with my staff. OMB as an organization is one of the real gems, as I've said and written in the civil service. It's just under 500 people, of whom 450-ish are civil servants, career. And they do their work analytically presenting things. And then you you get into that kind of Socratic process where you test the analysis, the assumptions. They're not approaching it from a political perspective. Obviously, the political lens goes on into putting it. Budgets are not just about numbers. They're about priorities. They're about beliefs. But you know, OMB is well served by having a career staff that, is just focused constantly on, you know, how well are things working, what can we do better.
All right. And if you make a tough choice and you decide the playbook is going to have to tighten its belt, is there an appeal?
The way the process generally works is around Thanksgiving, OMB does what's called pass back to the agencies. When I was at OMB the last time, I think I changed the tradition. Pass back, some administrations, was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving. I consider that cruel and unusual punishment that you don't send people their budgets as they're going home to their families. We do it the Monday after Thanksgiving. That's our goal. And there's then a short period for agencies to appeal. We try to work things out between OMB and the agencies. There is normally a process for agencies to go to the president should there be a need to. I was pleased last year that we were able to resolve agency matters without
appeals
to the president.
Wow, you're tough.
As agencies know, it's not like I have some secret pot of money. They're going to be appealing to move things around within totals. There's, for the most part, not going to be, we'll go up another couple of $100 million. If I did that, I'd be outside of the caps that we agreed to.
Interesting. I think we had a question right in this zip code. Yeah, thank you. And just to say who you are, please.
Hi, Shannon Monroe. You mentioned earlier that nothing should ever be off the table. Everything should be considered. In this environment of belt tightening and hard looks across the board, for instance, defense, I was wondering, are hard looks and reexaminations going to be taking place within the intelligence community and national security funding in an environment where we see a lot of agencies clamoring for some sort of presence in national security in hopes of getting more resources? So if you could speak to that, please.
If you don't have to look beyond the budget agreement from August to know that these are days of very considerable belt tightening and strategic reevaluation in the national security arena. The caps that were part of the Budget Control Act have a firewall separating security and non-security for the next 2 years. That means that there's almost $500 billion of savings we're looking to get out of the security arena over the next 10 years. I think that this is one of the most important reevaluations of our national security needs in a long time. We went through a very long period of time when there were virtually no questions asked about national security funding. I don't think that leads you ultimately to strength. Obviously, it gives you a lot of resources, but you need to always be asking the question, what is most important? There's only so much you can pursue with maximum effectiveness, and there's only so many things that can be executed. I'm not going to say that some of this belt tightening won't be hard. It will be a big job to implement both reductions in end strength and reductions in acquisitions while maintaining our position as the without equal most powerful nation in the world. I believe we can do that. I believe we can we have the best military in the world. We have the best military planners in the world. What they need is strategic guidance on what our goals and priorities are. They will accomplish their mission. So I'm actually quite excited about this process. I think that it's a process that will leave us stronger in the end, where we're focused on the things that we need to do with a real strategic understanding. And I don't think you can solve our problems by saying either defense or taxes or domestic spending are off the table. We got where we are by going through a decade. I was OMB director when we balanced the budget. And we balanced the budget when we had the peace dividend from the end of the Cold War. We had revenues go up because of the economy doing well and some tax policy. And we had spending come down because of policy. It's no mystery how we got into this problem. We had a tax cut we didn't pay for, we had wars we didn't pay for, and the economy went bad and revenues fell.
Okay. I'm going to get the hook in 2 seconds, so just real quickly, there's a number of distinguished former directors of the Office of Management and Budget. Who's someone that you emulate or admire and you can't name yourself?
Well, I would never name myself in that category. I had the privilege to work for two extraordinarily fine OMB directors, Alice Rivlin and Frank Raines. I had the privilege to work with a chief of staff who had been an extraordinarily effective OMB director, Leon Panetta. I know virtually all of the OMB directors of the last 20, 25 years. I have to say that somebody who isn't thought of first as an OMB director, but when you kind of go around the halls asking people who is a great OMB director, George Shultz's name comes up very often. And interestingly, when you go around the State Department, as I did when I was coming in as Deputy Secretary of State, his name often came up in the State Department as being a great Secretary of State. And I think the reason his name comes up so often is that, in addition to his intellect and his commitment to public service, he had a strong belief that part of your job as a head of an agency is to care about the agency, to mentor the people in the agency, to invest in it, to develop the careers of people in it, and to leave the agency stronger than you found it. And I've actually tried to use that as a kind of goal. I hope to be remembered as somebody who, in spite of the intense negotiations, in spite of the kind of frenzy of the day, cared about the agency as well as the day-to-day task.
What did you think about Senator Rob Portman, a Republican of Ohio, who was OMB director under President Bush?
I've known Senator Portman since he was Congressman Portman, and I think he's somebody who brings an enormous amount of intellect and commitment to public service. He's somebody who wants to work to solve problems, and I admire him.
And which speaker that you've worked with since then is most like Speaker O'Neill?
It's a hard one. I think they kind of broke the mold with Speaker O'Neill. He was the end of an era, and he had that unusual ability to see the times were changing and to bridge the kind of end of the Sam Rayburn New Deal era of speakers and kind of be the first speaker who used modern media. People don't think of that with his kind of burly mane of white hair, but it wasn't an accident that Chris Matthews sat in the desk next to me. He knew that he had to bring the speakership into the 20th century. He was a person who I think was one of a kind. So there've been powerful and important speakers since, but I can't make that comparison.
And last question: what's it like to sit next to Chris Matthews?
Well, the blessing is I can still hear out of my right ear, because in private conversation he has the same volume that he has on television. Chris is a good friend. I actually just saw him last night. He just published a new book on Jack Kennedy. It was great to congratulate him. And our families have been friends for a long time.
Okay. We thank our friends in Livestream Land. We thank our friends at Bank of America for making this conversation possible. Thank you guys for getting up early and for great questions. And Mr. Liu, Director Liu, thank you for a great conversation.
Thank you, Wayne.
Thank you guys very much.